Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Well, good evening and welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd. I'm here with my co-host tonight, Red Beckman. And I believe Dr. Kate will be joining us a little bit later in the show, but she's there being our kind host this evening. Red, how are you doing, buddy?
I'm not complaining. We didn't get that much rain today, so I figure that's a plus, but tomorrow it's supposed to be rainy all day, so we'll see.
Yeah, we're supposed to be getting a little snow here in Colorado tomorrow night. Would you please open us in prayer?
I can do that. Heavenly Father, we come to you recognizing that you are the sovereign in our universe. You are at the top of the pecking order, and we hope that you will help us so that we never forget that, never for a minute doubt that you're there and that you're available when we need your help, which is on a regular basis, of course. We need you tonight on this program. We want your guidance. We want your help. We want your wisdom. And we just pray now, dear Lord, that you would give us a good program, give us a good audience, and help us to give the audience something that they would consider to be a blessing. We pray now, we ask this and all, and we pray it in thy holy name. Amen.
Well, thank you, Red. I'd like to, we've got our guest ready to come on with us right now, but I want to say this. I'm not going to introduce tonight the 2004 Libertarian presidential nominee, and I'm also not going to introduce the Continental Congress 2009 president, but rather I want to introduce this lonely, disreputable outlaw that's known as Michael Badnarik. Welcome back to Walls in Our Minds, Michael.
Terry, thank you. That's a beautiful introduction. I appreciate that.
Well, you might want to explain to the listeners why I did that, but...
Well, I've just written a new book called Secrets to Sovereignty as an answer to the hundreds of how do I questions that people ask me. How do I drive without a driver's license? How do I not fill out my 1040 form? How do I carry a gun without a permit? Well, the truth is there are no government forms that can allow you to do that. There's no letters or paperwork that you can send off certified return receipt. Most of us have been unable to find that answer because we are looking outside of ourselves for the answer. What we need to do is we need to look deep inside and realize that the answer that we've been looking for is within us. And I really enjoyed writing this book. I'm very proud of my first book, Good to Be King. But I am excited about this book because I pretty much open up all the stops. You know, I'm not known for straddling the fence or being wishy-washy in my opinions. And I think this book is pretty much, it sprints out from the gate.
Well, I've been a fan of H.L. Mencken for a long time, and I found a lot of your quotes that were in here were Some of them I'd seen, but some of them I had not. And this was one of them that I did not recall seeing before. And you want me to give them that quote real quick?
Sure, absolutely.
This is in Michael's book, Secret to Sovereignty. He's got a lot of really good quotations in here. But Mencken here says, "The fact is that the average man's love of liberty is nine-tenths imaginary, exactly like his love of sense, justice, and truth. He is not actually happy when free. He is uncomfortable, a bit alarmed, and intolerably lonely. Liberty is not a thing for the great masses of men. It is the exclusive possession of a small and disreputable minority, like knowledge, courage, and honor. It takes a special sort of man to understand and enjoy liberty, and he is usually an outlaw in democratic society." So that's how you got to be this disreputable outlaw.
Well, I do genuinely appreciate it. I didn't realize it had come from the quote. But my mother tells me that the day I was born, they put me in her arms, and she was anticipating this small, helpless baby with the eyes closed. And she said that they put me in her arms, and I was staring at her with these dark eyes, and my two little fists were clenched. She tells people I was born with a book in one hand and a cigar in the other. And she said that she knew at that first moment that I was in charge and that she wasn't.
Well, I'd kind of like for you to, because I think, although most of our listeners may be familiar with you, certainly you've been on Walls in Our Minds before. We've talked about you, even in your absence, always in a good vein, I might add. And but I think it'd be a good idea for those listeners who are not familiar with you for you to give them just a little bit of background on yourself and maybe give us a little bit of history, how you came to write this book. You know, obviously you've been a constitutional scholar for a long time and have taught classes all over the country, including your, you know, online videos and stuff. But I'm kind of curious as to, you know, an undertaking of writing a book is not an easy undertaking. And, you know, you had to be in the right place at the right time and the right frame of mind in order to put your thoughts so fluidly on paper. And so kind of give our listeners a little background on yourself and how you came to write the book.
Well, all through school, I was a bit of a scientist. I'd love to go to the museums. After I got to college, I was working on computers. And computers are very unforgiving. You know, computers do exactly what you tell them to, not what you thought you told them to. And so it requires you to be very, very precise in your communication with the computer. And so I was a computer programmer for a long time. I ended up losing my computer job for a while in Austin, Texas. And quite literally, while I was waiting for the computer industry to come back, somebody called me and suggested that I run for president. I said, "President of what?" They said, "President of the United States." And I thought they were crazy. But I subsequently decided to run for president so I could teach people about the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, knowing that whoever I talked to would vote for the person that the Libertarian Party nominated. Well, then the big surprise was the Libertarian Party nominated me, and I basically took a detour in my life trying to fight my crusade for liberty. Because I discovered early on that most of what the government does is unconstitutional. And I ran for president, ran for Congress, thinking that, you know, we could just educate the people, we'll just make a couple of changes, we'll get the system back on track. Well, since then, I've come to the conclusion that the elections are all rigged. I continue to talk about rights versus privileges. I engage people in political discussions, even if I'm on an elevator. It has become pretty much an obsession. And after my first book, Good to Be King, which goes through the Constitution article by article, section by section, I was still frustrated. I couldn't understand why things were still bad. And I realized that people are waiting for someone else to do it. The huge Ron Paul support, I believe, had an underlying motive of, if we could just get Ron Paul elected, then all of our troubles will be over. We won't have to do anything because Ron Paul is going to fix it. And I think that's a flawed strategy. I've been telling people that liberty is within each of us. And if we don't all do our own part, then it's not going to happen. And I think that when people join a meetup group or liberty, they're all waiting for the group to come up with some kind of an idea. Well, if you've got to wait for the group, it's probably not going to happen. And so my book, hopefully, gives you the information that you need to be a one-man or a one-woman liberty fire and just go and do it. I mean, you don't need other people. You need to be an example for other people. And one of the things that has caused the liberty movement to stagnate a little bit is, you know, people's fear of failure. And so one of the chapters in the book talks about fear, you know, what it is, how it manifests itself in some people's lives, and, you know, what you can do to get over that fear. And, you know, eventually, you know, we're gonna move forward. We are going to restore liberty. I know that for a fact. I don't know how we're going to get it done. I don't know if I am still going to be here when that finally happens. But I am convinced that the spirit of liberty lives in the hearts of too many people to let the United States or the individual rights and the private property principles to die in the vine. And so I emphasize those inside personal things that people need to help restore our constitutional republic.
Well, you might want to say hello to Red Beckman. I believe you met Red in Illinois and back in 2009, and you've also spoken with Red here on Walls in Our Minds the last time you were with us, I believe. Red, would you like to say hello to Michael?
Well, I'll say hello, and I'm looking forward to this because I read the book. I had to prioritize it because that's the only way I could have gotten it done with all the things. I got too many irons in the fire, too much on my plate, but I took the time to read the book, and I can see where Michael has he's done some pretty extensive mental adjustments. This is something that the American people they don't know how to do that. They don't want to do that. They want to be just part of a crowd and go along with the flow. And, you know, they're missing out on something. Their lives are not near as exciting as someone that use their mental facilities to think with and try to make life count more, make it more interesting, and you know, it's just make life more worthwhile. I've seen so many people in my lifetime that have lived their lives and they had to have somebody to follow all every step of the way, and they don't know what they're missing. And so, you know, I think it's rather appropriate that we have Michael on our program because I think we have probably developed a reputation on this on this program every week to explore some new ground and do some new thinking. And so we want to give Michael a good welcome and give him some freedom to express himself because we want to hear what he has to say. So thanks for coming on, Michael, and we'll turn you loose.
Well, thank you. I'm hoping that even for your regular audience, we can get them to look outside the walls of their mind. You know, every time you think that you've pretty much got the universe stenciled out, you discover that there's a little bit more beyond it.
Well, Michael, maybe you want to give them a little taste of what's in there. I know you kind of started into the fear issue a while ago. I personally believe that that may be the biggest hurdle to someone actually living as a sovereign is this concept of fear and also peer pressure and wanting to fit in, like Red said, be a part of the group. And it is kind of a lonely life at times, and you have to go against the grain. And people are so fearful of failure that they can't succeed because they can't get past that hurdle. So I think that's maybe a good place for you to start tonight, is maybe talking a little bit about that fear and why you put that, why that was so strong. I mean, you've obviously had some experiences where you've run up against that, where you've told people, you've educated them, and they just weren't able to pull the trigger on acting as a sovereign. Maybe that was a bad pun. They were unable to initiate the process in their life of being a sovereign, of existing as a sovereign, because of those fears. And I maybe you could share a little bit of that with us.
Well, most of my personal experience has been fear-free. You know, my mother's biggest worry as I was growing up that apparently I wasn't afraid of anything. And, you know, I would just, you know, run off and do things. I never, you know, got seriously hurt. But, you know, she was always kind of looking over me. And when I became a swimming instructor, I literally could not understand that somebody would be afraid of the water. I mean, how could you be afraid of the water? Because everybody walks, everybody breathes, everybody swims. It was completely outside of my realm. And so I spent a great deal of time teaching this young man to swim and overcome what was just an incredible fear of the water. But for me, that was an external fear. That was somebody else's fear. And I had to figure out how to communicate with this man, but it wasn't my own fear. Well, eventually, I had someone invite me to go skydiving, and that required a great deal of concentration on my part, because the only thing that I had ever been afraid of was falling. And I had come to the conclusion that that fear is a symptom of ignorance. If you are afraid of something, it means that you have something you need to learn. You know, if you're afraid of the water, you need to learn how to swim so that you can control the environment. Well, using that same logic against myself, if I was afraid of falling, I needed to learn more about it. And, you know, it's a rather simple process to decide that jumping out of perfectly good airplanes would give me that experience. And the only thing that I was trying to prove was to myself. I wanted to prove that my logical brain would think through and would allow me to act rationally, even in the event that I was afraid. And turns out that skydiving really pegged my fear. It was the most terrifying moment of my life. And then a few moments later, it was also the most exhilarating as I discovered what flying was like. And so now I became a skydiving instructor with a very special ability. My ability was to know what the other person was afraid of and how that felt so that I could walk them through the steps. I could tell them what was going to cause them fear, how it was going to happen, and more importantly, what they could do to deal with it. And so one of the greatest joys in my life over the course of time has been teaching people to skydive superficially, but more importantly, helping people to overcome some really deep fear. Because, you know, once they've overcome that fear, it opens up their life. And I had one woman that I ended up teaching her how to skydive, and later she reported that she was afraid of horses. And I said, well, guess what we're going to do this weekend? So we went out to the stable, and we were, you know, petting the horses and learning about them. And we had the stable people come over and you know, give us some basic. And so we went horseback riding, which, you know, hopefully to most of the people on this program would be kind of just a casual weekend activity, you know, just to go for a ride up down the ocean beach. And as we were finally headed back to the stable, the woman looked at me and said, well, after you've been skydiving, it's a little bit silly to be afraid of horses, isn't it? And what you discover is that no matter what you might be afraid of, there is a way, a methodology of learning what you need to know and overcoming it. And so, you know, fear is a limitation. And if you love liberty, you presumably don't want limitations on your life. And overcoming fear can give you a sense of freedom and a sense of liberty and a sense of confidence that you can't buy at Walmart.
Are you still there, Michael? Okay, you just got quiet.
I'm here.
I wasn't expecting you to stop there. So I, you know, the book seems to be very personal to you.
It is.
And you're sharing some of your deepest. You know, I mentioned that you wrote this very fluidly. You know, it's a fifth. You know, you can move right through it, and it's. It's not something that, you know, puts you to sleep or makes you want to put it down. It's a fairly well written book, and I find it very personal to you. And I'm kind of curious as to what your expectation is of the reader. You know, we talked many times about that only 1 out of 10 people that hear a truth will actually respond to that and make a positive change in their life. And about 80% need to be in some kind of an accountability relationship before they'll make a positive change when they hear a truth. And there's 1 out of 10 that'll never make a change. And I'm wondering what your expectation is in the way that you shared so personally.
Well, Terry, I mean, as you know, the United States is in deep, serious trouble. If you and I had talked 20 years ago, and you told me that we were going to have a Patriot Act, I would have rolled my eyes and I'd have written you off as being somebody who was just really unreasonable. And here we are. We've got the Patriot Act, Military Commissions Act. God knows how many gun laws are going to be perpetrated on us now that we've had this terrible shooting in Connecticut. And the United States doesn't even look like the United States I learned about when I was growing up. And people will ask me frequently, you know, Michael, do you think that we can save the United States? Well, I don't know. But the answer is either yes or no. And if the answer is yes, if we can save the United States. We're going to need more than just the three of us. You know, Terry, Art, and Michael may be dedicated. We may have been doing this a long time, but we can't do it by ourselves. And my book is very personal. It is from the heart. People will get to know parts of me that I've never shared with anybody. But I'm in this 100%. It's like a skydive. After you leave the airplane, there's no going back. You can't say, well, okay, I'm just going to stop here halfway and I'll finish the rest of the skydive tomorrow. You're in. And that is how deeply I am in this fight for liberty. I ain't going back. I'm not accepting slavery. I'm not going to let the communists take over my country. Not going to let it happen. And I'm hoping that the honesty and the personal aspect of my nature is going to really ring true with people's hearts. You know, frequently you say, you know, if you want to win this battle, you got to win the hearts and minds of the people. That's what I'm aiming for. I want their hearts. I want their minds. I want them to know and understand how valuable life and liberty really are. Most people know that once you lose your life, you don't get it back. Dead is dead, period, sorry, you know, ain't coming back, at least not this, you know, form. And liberty's the same way. Once you lose liberty, they don't ring the bell at the end of the, you know, halftime and say, okay, the other team is going to kick off, you get your liberty back, or you get a couple of timeouts, or you get... No, you lose it, it's gone. And I'm not willing to let that happen. Now, the one thing I don't know is whether your listeners will become my readers and whether those readers will join us in this quest for freedom. I don't know that. It doesn't matter whether they join me or not. I'm going. It's like being at the Alamo. You know, victory or death. And if people respond and they understand and, you know, they come to support us at the last minute, then we will restore liberty. The United States will become once again the greatest country on the face of the earth. And, you know, gosh, wasn't that exciting. And if people turn off the radio, they don't read the book, you know, they don't care about freedom and liberty and private property, then, you know, perhaps I will be the last free man to die on this continent. I don't know. It's up to the listeners and the readers, and I'm in 100%.
Well, we've got, you had mentioned that you've got another appointment that you have to depart in about another half hour. Is that still the case?
Yes, it is. Yes.
Okay. I just want to be respectful of your time and, you know, give you an opportunity to kind of have some closing comments before that time hits. So I just want to be sure. I've got a number of questions that I personally want to ask, but we've got one person with a hand up. Are you ready to take a call from a question for somebody?
Absolutely.
Kate, would you please open up area code 817?
Hello?
817, you've got a live mic, sir. Who are we speaking with?
Hello, Michael. This is Bill Brismond. How are you?
Hi, Bill. Nice to hear from you.
Hey, I know you don't have a lot of time. I've got a very complex question I think the readers and the listeners would enjoy. With the Biden Council going on and with the rules coming down, I'm wondering what your thoughts are on our Second Amendment rights to keep and bear arms, our Fourth Amendment rights on privacy, and then I don't think a lot of our listeners may know about our 10th Amendment rights. The powers not delegated to the U.S. are relegated to the states. And then this buzz that's going on about the presidential powers of ordering the ATF to reclassify semi-automatic weapons to Title II firearms, if that is a factor and your thoughts on all. I know it's very complex, but I think the listeners will get a lot out of it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill. The most of the people in the United States are very conscious of the existing gun laws and gun laws that may be propagated here very, very soon. Now, there are two camps. You know, there are those people that believe that guns are inherently dangerous and we should work diligently to eliminate them altogether. And, you know, then the other group thinks that, you know, the right to life is defended by guns and the Second Amendment. There's a lot of Constitution stuff being spouted, much of it not accurate, as I think that Red will tell you. But keep in mind that we, the people, do not require government permission to exist. On the contrary, the government does require our permission to exist. We, the people, are the source of all political power in the United States. We ordain and establish the Constitution. We invented Congress, and therefore Congress and the rest of the government work for us. That's fundamental. Now I'd kind of like to talk a little bit about what is law, because most of us listening to this program are good law-abiding Americans, and we want to know what's written down on paper so that, you know, we can follow what society has deemed as appropriate. We love our fellow man. We don't want to hurt anybody, and we want to, you know, adhere to those guidelines. However, I want your listeners to keep in mind that just because something is written down on paper, just because a group of people call it a law, is not necessarily enough justification for you to respect it and follow it. Let me point out that Adolf Hitler never broke the law. He simply passed new legislation that allowed him to perform the atrocities that he's guilty of. And I'm just going to go out on a limb and suggest that most Americans would never follow Adolf Hitler's laws. Now, I'm not suggesting the United States is acting like Adolf Hitler. However, the same decision must be made. We have to decide whether the law is legitimate before we decide whether or not we are going to give it our unquestioned, unrivaled support. The Constitution is supposed to put limitations on Congress for the purpose of protecting our life, our liberty, our private property. Our right to life is perhaps the easiest one for people to think of. I don't know that it's necessarily the most important, but it is definitely the easiest to think of. If someone approaches you on the sidewalk and begins to choke you, I am going to wager large sums of money that you are incapable of standing there and allowing it to happen. Even if you've never gotten any self-defense training, you're going to wiggle and squirm and at very least make it difficult for the perpetrator to hold on to you. You're going to poke them in the eye, step on their foot. You're going to do something, you know, use some level of violence to stop the attack. That is called self-defense. It's a built-in automatic DNA reflex. Now, you have the right to defend yourself individually, not only from criminals trying to take your wallet, says in the whole discussion of the national government created by the Constitution, the founding fathers understood that in certain cases, the government itself can get out of hand, can become overbearing. And again, Adolf Hitler's, you know, Nazi Germany is a perfect example. Hopefully, Americans will not nearly let it get that bad. But if it's trending in that direction, it is time to stop it. And one of the things that we can do to protect our life is to keep and bear arms. A gun is an incredible deterrent. Nobody wants to hurt you if they know that you have the ability to fight back. That's what the Second Amendment is all about. Thomas Jefferson said the greatest reason for the people to keep and bear arms is to protect themselves against tyranny and government. That's the Second Amendment. I, Terry, I just want to take a moment and thank you, because at the Continental Congress, you accepted the role of chairman for the Second Amendment Subcommittee, and I think you did an excellent job, and I know how difficult that was with so many people voicing their opinion.
Well, it was a pleasure, and it was really a lot of fun, and I, you know, I cheated. I got help from Dr. Edwin Vieira, so I had him consulting with the committee, so it really helped keep us focused and on track to come out with a good article on that.
Yeah. The Fourth Amendment is all about privacy and keeping the government out of our personal private business. And the Fourth Amendment talks about unreasonable seizure. The government does not have the authority to come in and just probe around and look through your underwear drawer just because they think it'd be a good idea. Because, and the argument that they use is that if you are innocent, you shouldn't have anything to hide. Well, that's, you know, a double negative there. That is specious thinking. The government is not allowed to search your home, your car, your, you know, person, unless they have evidence, tangible evidence, of a crime being committed, and they think they can find additional evidence. And ever since the Patriot Act has all but nullified, just eliminated the Fourth Amendment, because the government claims to be able to do sneak and peek searches. They can come and search your home without your knowledge as long as they don't mess up the carpet. The Tenth Amendment is actually gaining a lot more awareness these days. The Tenth Amendment in general says that the state government has more power than the federal government. And that's exactly the way we want it. The state government is supposed to protect you and defend you from the federal government. And to my knowledge, at least 30 states have adopted 10th Amendment resolutions to reinforce that idea. So, and the last item on Bill's list was a Joe Biden committee on the Second Amendment, and I believe that Joe Biden has outwardly stated that they are going to push through, you know, anti-gun legislation, gun control legislation, whether anybody wants it or not. Well, I don't like the attitude. Even if the laws turned out to be helpful in actually protecting people's life and property, I don't like the attitude that Joe Biden thinks that he has the authority to do this, whether anybody likes it or not.
Well, Mike, is impeachable because he is breaching his oath of office.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so I think that overall the American people that would actually listen to your show or read my book are getting a little bit more awake. I have it on good authority. I haven't seen the actual numbers, but I've been told that in the 3 weeks after the school shooting in Connecticut, that Americans nationwide purchased 10 million guns. Now, that's a lot of guns. And to purchase 10 million guns in 3 weeks, I don't think these people are planning to purchase guns just so they have something to hand at the door when the government comes to confiscate those weapons.
I could be wrong, but I believe that that rate equaled over 4 or 5 times the amount of the rate of sale of guns compared to 4 years ago.
Am I still on, gentlemen?
It is just definitely amazing. One company, I am told, had a 3-year supply of AR-15. And in 3 weeks, that 3-year supply was gone. So Americans apparently have an idea that they need them, unless it's become like the Tickle Me Elmo doll, and everybody has to get it right away. I mean, I don't know what would cause such a fad, but Americans are very much alert these days.
We have two other callers online that I want to get on. One of those, I believe, is Brian, our buddy over in the Carolinas, who you met at, in Illinois as well, who was a delegate from over there. But before we go there, I want to give Red just a quick minute. Red, we've only got about 18 minutes time left for Michael, so I don't want to take a lot of time, but I know that you want to say something about the Seventh Amendment. We're not hearing you yet, Red. I hear it clicking, but you're not getting unmuted.
I forgot that I had muted. I had the cough, and I muted. I forgot it.
You're good.
I got so involved in the conversation that I forgot that. I'll tell you, as I told you before the program tonight, Terry, we haven't had anything come along that has polarized the American people like this has. The Obama recession and all of the problems that we've had has caused a lot of consternation on the part of the American people. And then this comes along, and wow, it is pushing a lot of people off of that fence. And they're getting on the right side of the fence, as far as I'm concerned, rather than the left side. And so I think that this is probably going to be one of the healthiest things that has happened to us in this country. Because if you talk guns, you can talk the Bill of Rights and all. And you asked about the seventh article of the Bill of Rights. We should have known that this was so very, very important, the seventh article of the Bill of Rights. It was so important that they don't teach it in law schools. Well, why wasn't it being taught in law schools? Well, there was a very concerted, very strong effort to let the seventh article of the Bill of Rights to drop through the cracks of time. And the lawyers, the students in the law schools didn't learn about the seventh article of the Bill of Rights. They didn't learn about the fact that we, the people, serving on a Seventh Amendment common law jury are actually the highest court of our land. And now, I'll tell you, we're going to be able to, we're going to be twice as effective or triple effective now as we try to make people aware of this in the days ahead now, because now they've got their eyes peeled on that internet, and my goodness, the amount of information on that internet right now is mind-boggling. And it's going to be one of the healthiest things that's happened, because the media, the major media that we've been so exposed to over the years, they're going to come out of this with a black eye and a bloody nose, I think, because they're going to be lucky if that's all they get out of it, because the people are able to compare what they're reading on the Internet with what the major media is, and we all know that the major media is not going to promote anything in the way of liberty or freedom. And so I really like the subject tonight. I like the way it's going. And so I won't say any more here. Michael's got, he's only got about 14 more minutes. So I'll shut up and let you guys talk.
Thank you, Red. But I wanted to bring out the fact, Michael, that the one way to set a common law court, if somebody's in a situation where they're fighting the government, setting that common law court is critically important, and the Seventh Amendment facilitates that. Do you want to comment on that, or do you want to go to another caller?
I will comment briefly because I want to get to as many callers as possible. Red is absolutely correct. People talk about the Seventh Amendment and go, it's almost as if it didn't exist. Common law is where it's at, and I encourage your reader to do as much research on common law as possible. But let's get to another call.
You want to open one up, Kate? I'm not sure. 864, perhaps?
Hello?
You're live.
Okay. Hey, hi, Michael Manerick. This is Brian Frank. I wanted to thank you for all the years that you've been helping people become aware and educate people on the Constitution.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I have two questions for you. First, I see I'm on your Facebook page, and it says, I will no longer participate in the global self-surveillance program. I like that. even though I'm participating in the global self, program. First question is an easy question: is will you drink from the Ohio?
Well, I will, but the armies of Africa, Asia, and I forget what else won't.
right.
It's a Abraham Lincoln quote. It's a very good one.
Okay. No, it's people like you that, got rid of my fear. I opened up a gold and silver business, and I have three stores now. It's people like you, and I wanted to, and just for what you do, thank you about that. And I have a serious question: is have you unsubscribed from voting, being a sovereign that you are?
Yeah, I don't have a voter's registration card, if that's what you're asking. I don't have driver's license. I don't have a concealed carry permit. Basically, I don't ask the government for permission. As long as I'm not hurting anybody or not, damaging their property, I can pretty much do whatever I want. And, most of what I do is try as hard as I can to travel around the United States and teach people about the founding principles that our country is based on, because, if we don't save it, it's not going to be saved. The Constitution doesn't protect us. We're supposed to protect it.
Right. It's people like you, that help get rid of fear by your books, and doing what you do would be fearful for many Americans.
And, Brian,
I just wanted to thank you.
Thanks for your comments, Brian. I gave Brian your number, your telephone number, Michael, so he could call you and arrange for some books. But we've got four other callers, so we better kind of move along.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Area code 805.
Hello, Michael Bednarik. Hello.
I'm here.
Yeah, I spoke to you about a year ago on the phone, and I brought up a topic that you said that no one else ever really brought up to your attention. So I'm going to toss it back at you and see if your mind's changed on it at all. I'm of the belief, it was during the convention in 1787 when they discussed how many people each U.S. House member should represent. And George Washington said 30,000 was representation and 40,000 was tyranny. And in 1913, they froze the size of the U.S. House at 435 members. And today, the population's tripled. So now there are 315 million people and 435 House members. And each House member has about 712,000 people. It's my belief that there should be a lot more representatives. And I brought that to your attention about a year ago, and you'd never had anybody really bring that to you. So anyway, I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that, and that's my only question.
What's your name?
Michael.
Yeah.
Michael Ward.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. It is. It is a question that, you know, very few people ever mention, and it definitely is an issue that needs to be addressed. But I think that there are other issues that are far more critical at the moment. Understanding and fighting off all these anti-gun legislation coming down the pike, et cetera, it needs to be addressed, but we need to do it after some of our emergencies have been handled. This is just not an important enough issue to drop everything else and deal with it. It's just a matter of priorities.
All right, area code 662.
Hello.
Hello, you're live.
Hear you. Hello. Can you hear me now?
We hear you.
Okay.
Yes.
This is Jim Borland, Terry.
Hello, Jim.
I wanted to think that my line of thinking was pretty much mainstream, but I've gotten to the point where I don't think that it is anymore, that the country has shifted so far to the left. And that being said, it seems like it really doesn't matter what the Constitution says, as long as you have so many people who are shifting to the left and shifting away from the Constitution and who are occupying power, it seems like our only recourse is either to capitulate with them or to draw the line in the sand at the first sentence of the Declaration of Independence. And I don't see the country moving toward the right. I see a more left swing.
Don't you? Hello?
We hear you now.
Yeah. Okay. You know, if somebody's trying to kill me, I'm not going to negotiate with them. I'm not going to say, well, okay, you can cut me, but you can't kill. I'm not doing that. And so you are correct that many, many people currently in power are strongly in favor of a communist or socialist type of government, which is similar to one of the statements that I made earlier. We have to know what law we are going to support. And I strongly recommend, I suspect that most of your listeners have already read Frederick Bastiat's The Law. If you haven't, it is time. I mean, you can download it from the internet right after this program is over and read it before you go to bed. You need to know that those fundamental principles. You know, you can't balance your checkbook if you don't know how to count.
Our Skype, I think, is breaking up a little bit, so I just want to let you know. I don't know if you were just talking or ready for another caller.
I was talking. I am ready for another call.
Area code 303. Somebody in Colorado is calling in.
Hi, Terry. Hi, Terry. It's Deborah.
Hi, Deb.
Hey. Hey, Michael, I met Terry and some others on my birthday, September 13th in 2009, right when the Continental Congress was happening, and it was truly my first bit of awakening to just about everything. And the first thing I did was sit down and watch your seven-part series, and I must have watched the whole thing three or four times. And I just wanted to call and thank you because you put it, it really held my interest, and you really put it in a way that I could grasp, and I didn't feel like talked down to. I didn't feel like an idiot. So I just wanted to thank you also for your work. And I certainly don't know all the details, but I've heard tell that there's a chance you might be fighting some physical issues, and I wanted to let you know that you're always in my prayers. And thank you, and that's really all I had to say, and God bless you, and I'm going to keep listening.
Well, thank you, sweetheart. That's the kind of feedback that makes all of my efforts worthwhile. That's lighting the fires of liberty. The founding fathers were able to communicate with me over the centuries with the Federalist Papers, and as I read their writings, my heart lit up with the wonder of freedom. And, you know, when I first ran for president of the United States, my mother asked me if the American people were ready for my radical ideas. And I told her they were not my radical ideas. They were Thomas Jefferson's radical ideas, Patrick Henry's radical ideas, and I was just converting them into modern language. And so to share those ideas with you and to have them fill your heart so that you truly understand freedom and liberty, it is now your job to share those ideas with your family and friends.
I believe that 817, Kate, is a new call. The first one was an 864. So, oh, I see. There was an 817. I'm sorry. Okay, never mind. You've got about 3 minutes if you want to get out of here at the top of the hour, Michael. Are you wanting to?
I'll take one more call. I can show up a couple minutes late.
Oh, 817, you've got your hand back up again. Do you want to talk or open them up and
yes,
see?
Yes, please. This is Grapevine, Texas. I just wondered if
Michael you have an open mic.
A little bit.
I think that was a yes, please. I can hear you.
Yes, this is Grapevine, Texas. I was wondering if Michael could explain to the audience about presidential executive orders. We're hearing buzz about the president ordering the ATF to reclassify semi-automatic rifles as Title II firearms, which would be in the same category as machine guns and will require extensive background search, registrations, and extensive fees, and how he thinks about the legality of that.
The government is slimy, like a snake. It keeps moving around. One minute it's there, next minute it's not there. People need to understand that executive orders, legitimate executive orders, transmit information from the chief executive, i.e. the president, to subordinate executives, you know, particularly one of the federal branches. That is a legitimate use of executive orders. So the story, as I understand it, is that President Obama is planning to send an executive order to Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Agency explaining that they should change the way certain types of semi-automatic rifles are categorized. Now, when a president sends an executive order to a federal department, in and of itself, that is a legitimate executive order. However, if that executive order said, for example, go out and kill all fat people wearing purple striped sweaters, well, that would obviously not be a legitimate order. because the purpose of the Constitution and the government that is created by it is to protect the life, liberty, and property of the people who live here. And I think it's pretty easy to demonstrate that going out and shooting anybody, purple sweater or not, does not protect their life. And the order, even though it was an executive order from the chief executive to a federal branch, would not be legitimate because of what the order was demanded. And so, from my point of view, the entire Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Agency, which spends approximately $1 billion a year for the purpose of putting gun owners and the Second Amendment out of business, is by definition an unconstitutional agency. And anything that they do to infringe on the rights of Americans is unconstitutional. And no executive order to that agency would be legitimate. And we need to eliminate alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. That should be a convenience store.
Michael, I'd like to make a quick comment on that. If people haven't seen Bill Whittle's Where Do We Go Now, or it's a deal where he's acting as a virtual president, he responds to that. I don't necessarily totally agree with him, but I certainly would acknowledge and agree that executive orders were never intended to legislate. That's the job of Congress, and an executive order that bypasses the Congress, in my mind, has no weight or authority at all, except from a de facto perspective. Before you go, Michael, we've had a number of people asking about Schaefer Cox, and there's an article in the Huffington Post showing that he's received a 26-year sentence. We've got political prisoners all over the place, one of which is one of the people that wrote on, gave you a review on your book. Bernard von Nothaus was a political prisoner for a while. We've got Kent Hovind down here in Colorado. We've got, Edgar Steele up in Idaho and Washington. Schaefer Cox, are you familiar with his current situation at all?
I don't know. I know Schaefer. I thought he was wonderful at the Continental Congress, a man that I truly respected. And I was told recently that his sentence was increased to 25 years or something, but I unfortunately haven't been able to keep track of anything more than that.
Well, I can tell you this much. They dropped the accusations that the state had on him because they realized that, they weren't going to be able to produce evidence to go after him on those charges where they were trying to say he was threatening judges and state troopers because his militia group had devised a counterattack plan, not an attack plan, not a threat to go after someone, but they simply devised a plan that said, if they do something to us, we're going to do it back to them. In other words, it was a defensive situation, not an aggressive one. But what they finally got him on was federal firearms violations. And it was the Fed charges that stuck and got him put in. So they have violated their rights and their Second Amendment rights and trumped up stuff, and that's how they got him put away for that time period. And if you want to comment further on that, go ahead. But I've got one other question I really want to ask you.
Well, I think that people need to understand that the American government doesn't need a good reason. In fact, they don't need any reason at all other than the fact that they don't particularly like you. They can fabricate whatever evidence they want against you. And if you think that you're going to keep low profile and not openly read Michael Badnarik's book because it's subversive or not listen to this radio program, well, then you already lost. If you surrender out of fear, you have allowed the other team to win. So, you know, this is all about standing up for freedom. You know, it's a little bit like the Alamo. And you don't know if reinforcements are coming or not. But a lot of our people who are in the Patriot movement have been basically sabotaged. They've had all sorts of artificial charges created by the government. And this is war. Even if people are not dying, you know, they are going to jail for invalid reasons.
Well, my last question, and then I want to give you an opportunity to mention where they can get your book and where your website is, all that sort of stuff. But my question is this. It's a tough one. How do we lay claim to creator-granted unalienable rights as declared in the Declaration of Independence and exist as defend our position or articulate our position as a sovereign without keeping God at the top of the pecking order?
Oh, well, if you're not going to keep God at the top of the pecking order, you're going to be in this all by yourself. You're going to feel like you're all by yourself, and you're probably not going to make it. But the way to do it is to declare it. You know, we didn't write a letter to King George asking for permission to write the Declaration of Independence. It is a declaration, and that's all you need to do is to declare. And so there are a lot of different ways to do it, but you just need to declare, you know, your independence, your sovereignty, your willingness to live under common law, you know, and the laws of God, and join with other people. We are the source of all political power. The reason that Congress gets away with so many unconstitutional actions is because we let them. And we're going to stop letting them very, very soon.
Well, tell the folks how to get your book and where your website is and all that good stuff, Michael.
My website is constitutionpreservation.org. Just not Constitution All, just constitutionpreservation.org. The book is not for sale. It is for barter. You know, you give me something of value, and I'll give you something of value. And the recommended barter unit is an ounce of silver. Send me an ounce of silver. I will send you a book in the next day's mail. If you don't have an ounce of silver, well, kind of shame on you, but you can call my friend Tim. Tim operates a precious metal distributorship in Florida. And his information is there on my website. Give Tim a call. He's very friendly and cordial, expecting your phone call. And he will explain to you how to send money to him. And then he'll hold my silver on reserve for me in Florida. And if you'd like to read excerpt from the book, you can find that at constitutionpreservation.org as well.
Any final comment, Michael?
Terry, I want to thank you and Red for all the work that you do. I mean, you know, most people will listen to your program and go, well, that was fun. That was kind of easy. But it is your relentlessness. You guys never give up. You are always here. And it is that consistency that makes it happen. It gives other people a sense of well-being because, well, all is right with the world because you know, Walls of Our Mind is here and we're listening and, you know, they get consolation from the fact that you guys are still on watch looking over America, and I genuinely appreciate that.
Well, thank you so much for coming on tonight, Michael. I do hope you'll give me a call next time you're you're in the Rocky Mountain region and have a meal.
Excellent. I look forward to it. Thank you, Red.
He's unmuting.
Okay. Kind of caught him off guard there with the sound. Well, I'm going to let you go. I'm just a couple minutes late, but I want to thank all of your listeners. And if anybody has any questions, they can send me an email at my website.
Thank you very much, Michael. I will disconnect your connection here.
All right. Stay
safe. Have a great night. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, Red, I hope you're unmuting. And, Kate, I hope you are unmuting as well, because I think we've got a lot to talk about after that. And I'd like to kind of hear your thoughts on this. Red, you're still muted.
Is that better?
You're good now.
Oh, boy. Market off to old age. I make a few more mistakes than I made in my younger days, I think. But I like to think that I'm a little more wise than I was in my younger days. But when people talk about sovereignty, and I've mentioned this before, I went to a tax strike news. It was a national convention in Denver in October of 76. And, that's a long time ago. It was 1976. And I heard a speech by Claire Kelly, a great, great, great lady patriot. I don't know if she is still with us or whether she's gone on to her reward or what the deal is, what the situation is with her. But she gave a definition of sovereignty, and I have never forgotten it. I'm sure I brought it out on a program here earlier in years back. She said, sovereignty is determined by who has the final say on the law in an orderly society where you have a government and people being governed and this and that. She gave a little explanation. She said, if you live in a country where they have a king, and you have you become part of a controversy, you work your way up through the justice system in the government, and if you have a particularly important question, a sticky question or whatever, it might make it up to the king. And the king looks at the case and the evidence, and he makes a decision. And that decision is the final decision. The king is sovereign, and he has the final say on the law. And I think that the founders of this country, when they wrote the Declaration of Independence, when they had the Articles of Confederation and the Constitutional Convention of 1787, and then added the 10 Articles of the Bill of Rights in December of 1791, I think they had every intention of making it so that we, the people, would be the ones to make the final say on the law. And I think that is why, as I mentioned in the last hour with Michael here, we should have known how important the seventh article of the Bill of Rights was, because the law schools have done everything they can for over 200 years to drop the seventh article of the Bill of Rights through the cracks of time. And they don't teach the law students about the 7th article of the Bill of Rights, and it's a sure thing. They didn't teach us anything in the government school, our education process. They didn't teach us anything at all about the 7th article of the Bill of Rights. And I have said now for a number of years that the 7th article of the Bill of Rights is by far the most important of all of the 10 articles of the Bill of Rights. There are the others, you know, we hear a lot about the 1st and the 4th and the 5th and the 10th, of course. We just don't hear anything about the 7th article of the Bill of Rights. And here it is, without a doubt, it is by far the most important. It is the one where we confirm our sovereignty. This is where we decide on whether a law is constitutional, whether it's a law we want to live under or whatever. And what we call the U.S. Supreme Court, that 9 government agents in Washington, D.C. in their black dresses, that is not, they do not have the final say on the law. They have the final say on the law and corporate law and that type of thing, but they don't have the final say on a controversy between the individual and a department or an agency of the national or state, the federal, or the city, county, any area of government, starting at the lowest level all the way through to the federal government. That 7th article of the Bill of Rights needs to be brought front and center to the American people, and I've been trying to do that, of course, for some time. And I can say that we're definitely making some headway. This anti-gun thing that has come along, I think it's going to backfire on the gun grabbers. I think it's going to backfire on the people that are promoting, gun control, because there's been nothing that's come along that's polarized the American people, like this thing that we've got going right now. And I think that we all need to be involved, and we all need to be, looking around us. And if we've got people that are sitting on the fence and don't know which way to go, we need to do whatever we can to explain to them, what's going to happen, what they need to do. Get on the right side of the fence, not the left. And I think that we've got some really exciting times coming here in this country. 2013 is going to be a landmark year for the United States. And so with that, I'll pass it back to you, Terry.
Well, let's come back to this topic, because Brian's put in here, he posted the 7th Amendment on the chat, and then he said it's kind of hard to really know what it means. We've got I want you to think about that one, and we'll come back and answer it before the show's over. Area code 727 has your hand up, and then I want to get Dr. Kate in here for her feedback on this. Area code 727, you should have an open mic.
Hello, sir.
There you are. Who am I speaking with?
My name is Ryan. I'm from Largo, Florida.
Welcome to Walls in Our Minds. Do you have a question for one of us?
No, actually, just have a brief comment I'd like to make. I really do appreciate everything you guys are putting out. I appreciate people who are supporting freedom. That's as simple as it is. There are so many people I have talked to in recent months following the tragedy of Sandy Hook that do not understand what limits or what lengths the government will go to disarm its citizens. And I've actually been posting YouTube videos recently because I want to be able to look myself in the mirror 50 or 60 years from now when our essential liberties are taken from us and be able to say, you know what, at least I tried and I did something. I let my voice be heard. There is a rally I will be attending next Saturday, the 19th. It's a national rally to promote gun rights. Everybody who's in favor of gun rights, I suggest you hit up the Facebook page, Gun Control Equals More Crime. His name is Eric, who has proposed this march, and I believe it'll be very successful because in my state alone, state of Florida, there is going to be over 1,000 people attending this march. It's a peaceful march. I feel it would be a very good, it's going to be very good in our favor. So I just wanted to thank you guys for putting this out. There are a lot of people that are starting to wake up.
Thank you for bringing that out. That will be National Gun Appreciation Day, January the 19th. We are also organizing to have a large group of people at the state capitol here in Colorado on that day, and I'm hoping to speak at that. So I appreciate you bringing that up, and we will definitely reiterate that next week. So thanks for mentioning that. Thanks for calling in as well, and I appreciate your comments. Area code 805, your hand is up, and you now have a live mic.
Oh, well, hi. I'm the guy who called about representation earlier with Michael Badnarik. Just want to clarify one thing with the other gentleman. The Seventh Amendment was actually Article 9 of the Bill of Rights. There were actually 12 bills that were proposed by the states to the federal government as our first amendments to the Constitution. And they were actually placed in the order of their importance. Now, the Seventh Amendment, which was Article 9, is extremely important. It's trial by jury. But the first article that was proposed had to do with the number of representatives, the idea that we would have 30,000 and then 40,000 and then one representative for every 50,000. That was never ratified. The second article in the Bill of Rights was agency, and it was finally ratified as the 27th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. It was how we would pay the representatives. So, in other words, they couldn't just pass a salary bill for themselves and then, you know, just be paid more. They had to face an election. And every other right that's in the Bill of Rights was placed in order of its importance. So the next, what's the First Amendment is now, was Article 3. Those were, you know, they called those the rights of conscience. Then there was the Second Amendment, which was Article 4, which was if the government didn't listen to you, you had your weapons to protect yourself. But the Seventh Amendment, as you know, we deem it important, you know, to have a jury trial, which I don't even know is as important as it was. I mean, you know, I mean, it is extremely important.
Well, we're gonna revisit that in just a minute. So if you'll stick with us, Red, we'll talk sure. about that. But right now, I want to get the thanks for calling in, by the way, Dr. Cade. I'd really like to get your feedback on the first hour of the show.
Well, thanks, Terry, and good evening, Red. You can hear me all, can't you?
I can hear you.
Very good. Good evening, everyone. I thought that was a terrific hour with Michael. He is truly an inspiration and very down to earth and very straightforward. And I think if people can take a lead from him in terms of the definition of personal sovereignty and how he deals with his life, I think that's going to be very, very good. And there are lots of ways people are searching right now for ways to stand up, if you will. I think there's a lot more that needs to be done at a local level, and I'm quite interested in, you know, how we are going to organize our own neighborhoods and our various cells, if you will, to basically on an individual basis bringing back and restoring our own country. So I really don't have much to add to that discussion. I'm quite interested in how we move forward. Just a couple of points that I just wanted to raise. Wyoming has introduced some legislation that would throw in jail any federal person who comes in to try to enforce gun laws. And I think the standing and the personal sovereignty and who has the final say on these laws, which we get to, again, this Seventh Amendment or the Seventh Article of the Bill of Rights is very, very important. So I'm sorry I don't have much to add to this. I'm as much learning as everyone else is. But I think it is really time. I mean, a lot of people have looked at 2013 as just, you know, the end of everything. And there's a lot of fear-mongering going on out there. And, of course, what did Michael address first was fear. Now, some of the fear-mongering that we see is just simply for people to get, hits on their radio shows or on their websites and so forth. And it actually is doing a disservice, because we don't have the straightforward thinking like from Michael and from Red and from yourself, Terry, that would put that, you know, put the fear in perspective. Who should we fear? It's certainly not the government. And as long as this fear-mongering is going on without the other side of it, as Michael was talking about earlier, then we, in fact, paralyze ourselves. And that is exactly what I believe the current administration wants to have happen, the current Congress and so forth. There really is nobody up there in D.C. and very few at the state level, in my view, who are standing up for liberty or know what it is. There's too much fear. And so I think it's going to get down to a lot of us personally and within our neighborhoods and with other like minds beginning to stand on this principle very strongly. So I think I'll just close from there, Terry. I'm more interested in continuing this conversation with you and Red on the Seventh Amendment, because that's got to be a key aspect of our strategy. And I think that people need to understand more about how we have the final say and what's going on. So anyway, with that, I'm sorry I don't have much more to say, but what can you say when you're following people like Michael Badnarik and Red Beckman and Terry Dodd? So I'll send it back to you, Terry.
Well, you know, I'm going to be the first one to admit that I'm not without fear. Michael has a rare personality. You know, some people that I've met that didn't have fear didn't have a brain either. I mean, they were clueless, and Michael's certainly not that way. So it's unusual to have as much knowledge and understanding of just what they can do to you and not have fear of that. I personally have a lot of fear of that. But to me, courage is your ability to overcome that fear. The one thing that has really helped me to overcome that fear is the acknowledgement and realization and awareness and research proving that we are in a huge spiritual battle. If it wasn't for God, I would not be able to overcome my fear. My fear of God is greater than my fear of government. My fear of losing eternity is greater than my fear of anything that can do anything to me in this life, in this mortal existence. And that is the key for me in overcoming my fear. And people have become numb to that. I was numb to it for a part of my life. I just pursued my own interest. And it makes for a person of not particularly high integrity. And even those who have integrity, I don't hardly trust their integrity if it's all about self. Now, Red, you can make comment to that if you want, or you can go back and I think we need to get back to that Seventh Amendment situation, because I think we need to have a discussion about what that's really about. How is it that that can set a common law court? Because these courts that are UCC courts or admiralty courts or contract courts, you know, we're dealing with these de facto corporations that these judges are no longer public servants. They represent the corporate interest. That's true of the people of the bar. It's very, very difficult to set a common law court. Most people don't have a clue how to go about doing that. And like you said, Red, it's not only is it not taught in the law schools, it's deliberately avoided and it's deliberately written out of the rules of civil and criminal procedure. So, Red, we've got another caller with a hand up. Do you want to get into that now or you want to take the caller first?
Well, let's see what they've got, what kind of a question, or let them speak up, but we aren't going to give them the rest of the program because we're running out of time. We got 29 minutes.
That's exactly correct. Area code 478, you should have an open mic.
Hey, Terry, this is your big brother in Georgia.
Hey, Ugly, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing fine. I've been listening to y'all, and I wanted to call in, and, you know, I was really glad to hear Dr. Kate come in and give us her views as far as, and my comments. You know me, I'm not much of a talker, I'm a doer, and I have always, my question has always been, where do we start? And what do we do to start putting together an organization that will force somehow a development of a common law court or do whatever is necessary to make us be able to enforce the Seventh Amendment?
You know what my answer to that is going to be, don't you?
Well, I kind of know, but you probably knew when I called in, Herbie, you probably knew what my question was going to be, too.
No, I didn't know what your question was going to be, but I don't believe, you know, we've set up these citizens grand juries, these common law grand juries all across the country, and we've actually gotten it all the way up to the Supreme Court, or to a district court in Washington D.C. where they've admitted that these presentments are valid, they're constitutionally lawful, but they have no means of any civil procedure or criminal procedure of what to do with them. There's no way to enforce them. And since we have given up our well-regulated militia, we've still got our arms. Somebody's breathing heavy, so you might want to back away from your microphone there. But we've, without having a well-regulated militia, there's no way we're going to be able to enforce redress of grievances. We've been petitioning formally through We the People Foundation. We have formally petitioned ever since 1995, and it's gotten us really nowhere. And until we have a way to enforce it, and they've got to be more afraid of us than we are of them, these things are going to go nowhere. Well, how do we get to that? How do we get back to a well-regulated militia? Well, I believe that we've got to back out of this ambush the same way we got into it. We've got to break the taxing banking vortex. And the best way, the most sensible way, the most well-researched and lawful way to go about that is the sound money legislation that was written originally for New Hampshire by Dr. Edwin Vieira and has been proposed in a number of states. They almost got it through in Utah. They ended up just making gold and silver legal tender, but they took out all of the teeth of the legislation. We've got to get sound money back. We've got to put proprietary ownership of our currency back into the hands of the people and out of the hands of the banksters, because the banksters are behind, I mean, there's a reasonable argument that they are behind all of the bad stuff that's going on, everything from us not having standing in the courts to buying off or scaring off our legislatures and our installing the people in the executive branch, installing judges in the so we've got to have a practical approach, as Dr. Kate reminds me of often. So the only way to do that is on a local basis. We're never going to get anything done on a national scale, so organizing on a national scale isn't going to get it done. We've got to organize at the local level. You don't have to call it a militia. You can call it a citizens group, you know, whatever. There's a zillion different things you can call it, but you've got to organize and get a grassroots efforts going in your local area, no bigger than your state. And you've got to get this sound money legislation through in a state, and it's going to take at least a couple of $1 million in each state in order to get it done, because you've got to support legislators, you've got to sponsor them, you've got to print newspapers, because you got to get to the people in the outlying areas of your state. Not all of them have computers or frequently watch their emails. You've got to put it in print and be able to distribute it out there. You've got to educate people. You've got to have an education program within your state in order to go about getting this kind of legislation. So, you know, that's where it starts. And, Kate, if you muted him, unmute him for a second, please. Randall, you have an open mic.
Yeah. Well, I'm still here. And, you know, I understand what you're saying, Terry, and I understand that it's going to have to probably start in some state, a few small states. But to me, I'm just wondering how we could put together a national organization that could help these states, help them organize. And maybe there's somebody listening to our conversation that might come in and give us some ideas as to how we can get maybe a small national organization started, that where we could work with the states to at least get it started. Because I'm a belief like you. We could talk about this. You've talked since 1995. We could talk about it till the year 2025, and we'd still be where we are today unless we develop a plan to put together a small organization to help these states to make things happen. It's not going to happen by itself, and you know that.
Well, I believe that a national fundraising campaign would be in order, but I believe that the organizations have to be on a local state-by-state level. Now, we can do some printing, we can do some educational materials on a national level, but the organization of it's got to be grassroots, just like the original militias were intended to be. A militia cannot be effective unless it is organized at the grassroots. Anything else, Randall, before I give Red the floor, because he said he wanted some time?
That's all I have, and I just wanted to throw that in, and I sure appreciate what all of you people are doing, Michael and Red and you and Dr. Kate, and we just all need to keep our minds working and find out how to make it happen. And
thank you,
y'all,
Randall.
Have a good evening. I'll keep listening.
Always appreciate you. Appreciate you calling in.
Thank you.
Red, you have the floor.
I will try to make this as brief and as clear as I can, but I want to start with reading the 7th article of the Bill of Rights first, and then we'll go from there. And it starts out and it says, in suits at common law, where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved. And no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise re-examined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law. Now, I want to, the earlier caller, he said that the 7th basically just preserves the right to jury trial. Well, it's more than that, because of that clause in there that says, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise reexamined in any, that three-letter word, A-N-Y, is all-inclusive, in any court of the United States, and that includes the U.S. Supreme Court, then according to the rules of the common law. The rules of the common law confuse some people for the simple reason that they're not familiar with the Ten Commandments, because the basis of the common law comes right out of the Scripture and the Ten Commandments. Anyway, it is in the law schools. I've had confrontations mostly on a friendly basis with a number of attorneys around the country over the last 25 years. I've asked them, you know, what the 7th Amendment is all about, and most of these attorneys don't even know what it has to say, and the only ones that did have anything to say say, oh, that's where we our right to a trial by jury is preserved, a constitutional preservation, you might say, of our right to a trial by jury. I had filed my first federal action demanding a jury trial in the summer of 1976. That's quite a while ago. And it was an Internal Revenue Service controversy, and there was a good deal more than $20 involved. And I was not a corporation. I was an individual an entrepreneur. I was self-employed, and I had a controversy with these people, and so I filed an action. And I didn't cite the 7th article of the Bill of Rights in particular, but I demanded a jury trial. And the Justice Department put in a motion for the judge to just arbitrarily throw my case out, summarily rule against me, and there wasn't even a hearing. Over a period of years there, I filed 3 or 4 of these, and each time it was the same thing. I kept reading Title 18, the U.S. Criminal Code, and Sections 241, 242. It told me that anybody that denies the constitutionally secured rights to an individual, that's a federal crime. That's a felony. And so in 93, I sued the federal judge that had dismissed my federal cases where I demanded a jury trial in each and every case. And we never even got a hearing. I mean, talk about a railroad situation. It was a kangaroo court or whatever. It was pretty bad. And I sued that federal judge, and I cited him for criminal action. I was a Title 42 where I was suing for damages, and Section 1983 case. And on the front cover of my lawsuit, my complaint, on the right-hand column, all they put at the top of the page is the judge's name that is assigned the case and the case number. And I wrote in large print below that, all facts to be tried by Seventh Amendment common law jury trial. That case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. It was docketed in August of 1996. And this was in Montana, Billings, Montana, and a lawyer friend locally told me that he'd been a lawyer for many years in Billings, Montana, and he said, I don't think we have an attorney in all of Billings, and that's a city, the largest city in the state of Montana, with probably 200 or 300 attorneys in it at least. And he said he didn't think there was an attorney in all of Billings, Montana, that had ever argued a case before the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, I'm not an attorney, and I don't want anybody thinking I'm an attorney, because that's an insult to me. And I want no part of the attorney's ball game and what they're trying to do to us. Anyway, in December of 96, the Solicitor General, who is the attorney in the Justice Department in Washington, D.C., he is the one who defends the government in all cases before the U.S. Supreme Court where the government is a party to the action. And, of course, the government was a party to the action. But the solicitor noticed all the parties to the action in December of 96 that he was not going to oppose me because I was correct in what I was saying. And so that case is still docketed with the U.S. Supreme Court after all these years, and I don't ever anticipate them, looking at that case and making a ruling. because what I did is I said that the judge was making findings of fact and conclusions of law, and he didn't have that authority because he is a government employee, which means he is a government agent. He is a beneficiary of the tax laws. He was a party to the action. And it's common knowledge that you cannot be a judge in your own controversy that you are a part of. And, of course, we have gone on. I have been talking Seventh Article of the Bill of Rights for well over 25 years. And it takes a lot of time to, you might say, dig up something that has been left buried for so long. You know, we complain about the congressmen and the senators, a do-nothing Congress and all, and I reminded a friend of mine who is a retired school administrator from a large city school system. I reminded him that we have to remember that all those people in government all went to the same schools that you and I went to, and we were educated in government schools, and so that federal judge, that federal prosecutor, all these different agencies, they are being, they're trying to make the system work the way they were taught in a government school. And I'll tell you, it's not easy to get rid of that propaganda once it gets planted in your mind and you let it mature over years and years and years. And so we've got to use our heads a little bit here and recognize that the government, we're having a real struggle with the federal judges and the judges in the state courts and such all across the country. They all supposedly took the oath, the same oath I took when I went into the military, to uphold and defend the Constitution from all enemies, foreign and domestic. But they don't seem to understand what that oath means. And so it took me many years, but I was by myself. I didn't have any help other than when I ran into Lysander Spooner's book. And I said, wow, I've been right all this time, and here I find that there was somebody in the past there that had this understood, and he had this all figured out. And so we're branching out, we're getting out there, and we're you know, we're helping people with their 90-day letters with the Internal Revenue Service. And they go to the tax court, and we've been able to, as far as I know, we have won every single case, and we'll continue to win them all. If we go get the individual and get them quick enough so where we can educate them a little bit and so that they can neutralize the tax court judge, because it's not really a court at all. It's a government ripoff deal. And the judge is a beneficiary of the tax laws, and that's why you don't win many cases in tax court. But we've got to do more than that. We've got to go and we've got to confront the U.S. Supreme Court with the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court, yeah, they can go ahead and handle the lawsuits between the states and as they were commissioned in the in Article 3 of the Constitution, and they can handle the disputes between corporations and such, but between you and I, the citizens down here at the grassroots, if we have a controversy with the FDA, the ICC, ATF, whoever they are, I don't care what agency of the government is there, if the controversy, if the value in controversy is over $20, you can use Rule 38. Don't forget that. It's Rule 38 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And you use the First Amendment the right to petition for redress of grievance. You demand the Fifth Amendment due process of law, and we've had some really very interesting cases, even in traffic court, where people have used the seventh article of the Bill of Rights and used it very, very effectively, because when you cite anyone that calls themselves a judge, and I don't care if it's a city court traffic judge or whatever, they are all beneficiaries of the tax law, and they have to go by the judicial code of ethics that address the question of conflicts of interest. And so you've got to have a jury of your peers to make the finding of facts. And then you don't go on up on appeal, because if you do your job and you can't have a lawyer, you can't have a lawyer going in there and representing you, because if you do that, you're going to be immediately in equity or admiralty court, and you don't want to go there because the deck is stacked against you. So, and nobody knows your controversy better than you. You can have a lawyer sitting at your elbow helping you form questions and that type of thing. You can have all your questions written down that you want to ask and all that. But what we have found out is that in most of these cases, if you are right, if you have been honest and straightforward, and all the federal government, the state government, the county, the city, none of them want to tangle with you in a seventh article of the Bill of Rights lawsuit. They don't want to tangle. They will settle. After this case was docketed with the U.S. Supreme Court back in 96, I had another case, a quiet title action, and when that case was docketed, within 2 weeks, it was an IRS case, and within 2 weeks after that case was docketed, the district counsel called and said, we've got to settle this case, and I got $145,000 out of them. It was my money, of course, but I got it, and they were more than happy to get rid of it. And the attorney, when he was asked, the district counsel for the IRS asked him why they were in such a hurry to get this case solved and resolved, he said, we're going to have a very bad precedent. And the bad precedent was the seventh article of the Bill of Rights and the common law, and it's law that you and I, at our grassroots, we can utilize it, and we've got to learn how to use it. And I've probably took more time here than I should have, but I've been trying to talk as fast as I can, too. But I'll turn it back to Terry, and I'm sure we'll have more discussion on this in on future programs. So I'll try to be available.
We got about 7 minutes left, and Kate, I was hoping you would make some comment relative to Wounded Knee and the other attempts at the federal gun confiscation, and also other ways that they are now eating away at our sovereignty. I mean, we've got to work back at them with 1,000 cuts, like you've mentioned from time to time, but they're certainly working at us with 1,000 cuts. They are coming at us in so many different ways, and I thought maybe you could try to give us a little bit of a background on that.
Well, I just got an email from a colleague, actually Tony O. Red, you know Tony. I just got an email from him because of this discussion on guns that we've been having. And I don't know if anybody knew this or remembered, but what the Wounded Knee Massacre was about on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. December 29th, 2012 marked the 122nd anniversary of the murder of 297 Sioux Indians at Wounded Knee. I didn't know this, but the slaughter began basically agents of the 7th Cavalry had come to confiscate their firearms, quote, for their own safety and protection. So the slaughter began after the majority of the Sioux had peacefully turned in their firearms. when the final round had flown, of the 297 dead or dying, two-thirds, 200, were women and children. There's also another video out that is called No Guns for Negroes. And, again, is showing historically the purpose of gun confiscation is to enslave or murder. And as these cases come forward and as, you know, the federal agents move into your neighborhood to try to confiscate guns, this is exactly what we have to do in terms of taking these guys in a Seventh Amendment jury. Seventh Article of the Bill of Rights jury, because these are, if we're the ones to decide what laws are lawful or not, or constitutional or not, this is exactly what's happened. Executive order or no. I mean, Michael Bednarik was right about Biden's attitude. We're going to pass these things whether you like it or not. And that's how far this country has gone. They're not even trying to hide their disdain for the Constitution and their desire to overthrow the United States. And so whether we like it or not, these are things that we really need to bone up on and to really understand our history. I don't know if you saw the video that was produced about 1942. It was about an incident in 1942 in Tennessee where the town had been taken over by really rogue officers and so forth. And the people brought out their weapons and they drove those people out of town and took the town back. Just 1942.
There was a sheriff's election. And they refused. They stole ballots and they tried to hold them so that people couldn't count them because they knew the sitting sheriff was going to lose the election and he was corrupt. And the fellow that actually won the election would have won it had they been able to count the ballots, organized a local militia group, and they went in there and they took that sheriff's office and regained those ballots and then put him out of office.
So
that really happened. That's a true story.
What we've got to learn from history and what we've got to also learn about how people responded when it was our natural instinct to protect our rights and, you know, to safeguard the election system, for example. Look at what happened in the theft of the 2012 election. Where were the folks in Tennessee when we needed them? But this is very serious, and on the other hand, it's just the tip of the iceberg. So I think it's important that we really not let anyone rewrite history. There was a video I looked at today about basically the language that's being used, you know, the shooters. No, the people who are doing the mass murderers are mass murderers. In Sandy Hook, in Aurora, Colorado, in other places, the language that the media and everyone is using is quote-unquote the shooter. So anyone who is a gun and goes and has a gun and goes and shoots is a shooter and associated with mass murder. Anyway, Terry, we just have about 90 seconds left, so I'm going to just say thank you for that opportunity, and let's continue this discussion next week.
All right. Would you like for me to close us in prayer?
Please do.
Red, did you have any final comment, or do you want me to go ahead and close?
No. I'm waiting for your prayer.
Thank you. Almighty Father in heaven, we acknowledge you as our creator, and we recognize, Father, that we have no sovereignty except by way of your delegation, because you are the ultimate sovereign. And we know that we've got to keep you at the top of our pecking order in order for us to claim any unalienable right. Otherwise, we are nothing but a part of the animal kingdom and here by accident and have no unalienable claim. Father God, we just pray that you help continue this educational process and help us to learn, but Help us to open the ears and hearts of people. We pray that your spirit go before us and that you open many hearts and many eyes and many ears and help people to understand your truth. Because what this regime is doing in their effort to control the world and their acceptance of Lucifer's offer to grant them kingdoms of the world if they will bow down before him. I just pray, Father, that we can defeat this regime and that you would go before us and open these people's ears and open their hearts. And I pray that we can help them to turn toward you, because you're the one that deserves all the glory. The righteousness is yours. We know that your victory is ultimate. We know that only you can sustain us eternally. And it's upon that we rely, and we ask for your guidance, and we ask for your help. We ask for courage. We ask for clarity. It's in the name of your Son, Jesus the Christ, Yeshua HaMashiach, that we pray. Amen. Good night, everyone, and thanks for joining us tonight, and we'll see you next week on Walls in Our Minds.
Used to be full.